Welcome to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. And all this hour, Luke Burbank is with you too, the host of Public Radio's Live Wire on Saturday evenings. Thanks for hanging out with us this hour, Luke.
Thanks, Bill. Glad to be here.
Luke, you are coming to us from the computer systems from Bellingham, Washington, which is, I would guess, a very bicycle-friendly city.
Yeah, it is a place where people like to get close to the outdoors. There's lots of cool trails you can ride on and other adventures you can take. And I think that kind of bleeds into city life here. I tend to see, this is anecdotal, but I see a lot of people coming into the co-op, stepping off their bike. It's a pretty bike-friendly town, I think.
Unicycle-friendly, too, I would imagine.
Yeah, regrettably so.
Okay. Well, that's where we're going to start this hour, on the wheels. We're going to start this show from a dead stop, so we'll be a little wobbly at first, and then we will get up to speed. Have you ever ridden around on one of these neon green bicycles that you find around in Seattle? I think the answer is probably no. I haven't. Most of us haven't. This is the Pronto Bike Share Program. It's been around since 2014, and it's in some trouble. The question is, what's the potential in this bike share program, and what should we do with it? Seattle's Transportation Department wants to buy Pronto and expand it. The department's Nicole Friedman says bike share should be part of the city's transportation network, and it needs to be bigger.
It's about building out that network, getting into that sweet spot range of 100 to 150 stations. And what you see is the trips for bikes increase dramatically. The overall trips increase dramatically.
Okay, so that argument is more bikes means more riders. That's the hope. KUOW's growth and development reporter is with us too, Joshua McNichols. Hi, Josh.
Hey, Bill.
Why would the city take over a troubled Pronto bike share program?
Well, they think, for one thing, they think about it like a transit agency. I mean, they're saying bikes are sort of transit. It's part of our transit system. But they also think they could save a little bit of money. For example, they wouldn't have to pay interest in the same way as this nonprofit developer does, the nonprofit company does. They'd basically be cutting out the middleman, all the sort of overhead workers who are associated with this nonprofit that are helping run it now. And they say also most cities our size that have a bike share program own their own system. So they say it's sort of the best way to do it.
But of course, the question is, if the city owned it, would anybody use it? How popular is Pronto right now?
Well, that's one of the problems. It's not very popular now. People are only riding on these bikes an average of one trip per bike per day. To put that in perspective, I spoke with this guy, Paul DeMeo. He's a consultant, and he's worked with a bunch of bike sharing programs, including the one in Washington, D.C. He says, you know, D.C. has a lot of the same obstacles as Seattle, including bad weather. And despite what people think about it, it has some hills. But bike sharing is popular there.
When there's, you know, freezing outside and or you know, in the 40s, and it's cold, and you know, people are still riding about 2.5 trips per bike per day, and in the summer it's about 5 trips per bike per day in the D.C. region.
Okay, so then the D.C. region, they managed to the obstacles to riding, sharing.
They're basically riding these shared bikes a lot more than we are riding our shared bikes.
Okay. Well, D.C. aside, if it's not popular in Seattle, why would the city think, hey, more of it?
Well, they're not going to expand it right away. This money that they're talking about allocating right now would purchase all the assets owned by the nonprofit. But eventually they want to expand it because for the same reason that people talk about expanding light rail, right? They say we may have, we've got pretty good riders on light rail, but they say we could have a lot more if we have more stations because then there's more places for you to go to. And they say the same thing with these bike share stations. If there's more places for people to ride, then more people will actually ride them. That's the thinking anyway. But you have to make it convenient for people to ride bikes. And a lot of people are sort of scared to ride in the city with all its traffic and stuff. So it'll be interesting to see if when the city eventually does expand the service, if they also roll out, you know, bike lanes in the area where these stations are. But it's all part of this strategy, the last mile strategy, where they're trying to connect, you know, we're changing as a city from a city of single-family residences into a city of, you know, big apartment buildings with transit going through the middle. And so how do the people who used to drive into these neighborhoods get to these neighborhoods? Well, one way could be bikes in some instances.
Okay, so maybe the future will be even friendlier to bike share.
Maybe.
So I'm a Seattle taxpayer. Is this a good purchase for the city?
That's a good question. I mean, right now, the operation isn't bringing in enough money to cover their operating costs. But they say that part of the story isn't quite as bad as it seems. At least that's what Pronto says. They say that, you know, the city kind of approached them in May of last year and said, hey, we're going to take you over. We're totally behind you. And we'll make that happen on September 1st. But then for a whole bunch of reasons, that offer sort of kept getting delayed and delayed. And, you know, the CEO of Pronto quit to take another job because she thought her job was going to end. And it, you know, and now, so they basically shut down Pronto. And they, I mean, they've still got a smaller board and stuff, but they're not raising money in the same way that they were before. And so that's cut down on their income. So that's one reason why it looks like they're more in the debt than they are.
Joshua McNichols is KUOW's growth and development reporter. Again, today, the Seattle City Council is discussing whether or not to buy the Pronto bike share program. Also with us all this hour is Live Wire host Luke Burbank. Luke, what did you decide? What should Seattle taxpayers do? Expand bike share or let it die?
Well, at the very least, preserve what's already been put in my opinion. I mean, if we learned anything from the Simpsons episode about the monorail, it's that the major infrastructure investments, particularly when it comes to mass transit or if it comes to something like this, which gets people out of cars, you never regret having invested the money 10, 20 years later. It's always hard to get the political will to do it in the first place. And, you know, D.C. apparently has more people riding bikes. And I lived in D.C. I think this is because in D.C., a lot of people take the D.C. Metro. They have a really effective system. So if you live out in Northern Virginia or somewhere else in the city of D.C., it's very likely that you take one of the different lines to get into town.
Right.
And then you walk up from the underground metro station and there's a bike share. We don't have, I think, in Seattle as many people even now that are using mass transit to get down to close to where they're going to go. And so I think once the mass transit is better in Seattle, once the light rail is expanded with that, I guess, trolley that's running on First Hill now, when it all starts to come together, then you have a lot of people who are getting out of a mass transit situation who could use a bike to ride the next 6-7 blocks or a couple miles.
Right. So, Joshua, good point. We may be stuck in this situation where you have some people saying, look, people don't want to ride bikes. It's hilly. It's hard. It's wet. Just there's the proof. Maybe we're just stuck in a situation where we haven't built it all up enough yet. That's a hard case to make to taxpayers, though.
Yeah, it is.
Joshua McNichols reporting for us on growth and development here. So city taxpayers have an interest in a bike option, that it's cleaner, less wear and tear on the streets, more mobility. On the other hand, Luke, you could say, look, if you need a bike, you've got a bike. It's not that expensive to have a bike. So, you know, we're just when would we ever admit to ourselves that we don't ride bicycles as much as we wish we would? Is there ever a point?
Yeah, the same day that we admit that the Seattle Seahawks are not the best pro football team in the land, which would be never. I mean, it really, Danny West needs peace in the Times talking about how the failure of this bike program really causes us in Seattle to take a hard look at our idea of ourselves. I mean, look, what is it? $1.4 million is a number that I saw. Is that the cost of the program, or is that what it would cost to keep it around? I mean, it doesn't seem like a huge amount of money. And I do think that as traffic continues to get worse in town, those bikes are going to become a more and more appealing option. And so to me, it's not my money because I live up here in Whatcom County now, but if I were living in Seattle still, I think I would think it was a good use of a small fraction of my taxpayer money. I do think, though, that riding a bike, whether it's a Pronto or just your bike from your house, commuting on your bike to work takes an amazing amount of planning. You have to coordinate what your situation at work is going to be, like how do you get out of your possibly wet or sweaty clothes? If you want to go somewhere afterwards, if that's too far away, what do you do? There's just a bunch of logistical hassles that are created. And I think a lot of people like the idea of riding a bike to work. But when you actually get down to the nitty gritty of the logistical stuff, it's like making a New Year's resolution to work out more. It's great in theory, but the follow through is where things tend to fall apart.
Reporter Joshua McNichols, any final piece of information for us?
Just that, you know, that $1.4 million, they say, at Pronto, they say that's not a big deal. They could make that up with sponsorships very easily. And they had plans to do that that they then couldn't do. So,
City Council talking about it today. And you've been listening to us talk about it with our growth and development reporter, Joshua McNichols. Luke Burbank, Bill Radke, back in a moment with more KUOW's The Record. KUOW's The Record. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Bill Radke. So picture this. You're home one evening, sipping a glass of wine, checking Facebook, and you get a text. Huh. It's from your boss. Huh. You've been fired. That happened to people who worked at an upscale Seattle hair salon. The Seattle Times reports about 50 employees of Seven Salon in Seattle's Pacific Place Mall got a mass text message Saturday evening saying the salon and its academy had closed for business reasons. Some hairstylists will get compensation packages and could transfer to the firm's other salon in Bellevue. Luke Burbank, is this any way to tell people they've lost their jobs? Is this the world we want to live in?
I'm okay with this world, Bill, because I have been fired face-to-face many times, and it's not like that's anything great. You know, I mean, there's this idea that if this would have just – if these conversations could have just happened between one human who doesn't want the other human to work there anymore, this would have been like a, you know, kumbaya session. Right. Like, it sucks no matter how it's happening, and I mean, you know, being notified via – text message doesn't seem that much worse to me. I am personally disappointed because I have one of these cards for this salon for a free haircut.
Oh,
because actually,
really, you're the victim in this.
I mean, yeah. Can we make it about me for 1 minute, Bill? No, I got one of these cards for a free haircut there, and I was excited because it was a pretty posh place. And now I guess it's no more. Although maybe I can take it to the one in Bellevue.
Right. If the employees are upset, though, because it feels impersonal and they're left with a whole bunch of unanswered questions, is it still a humane way to fire somebody?
No, I think it's the coward's way out, definitely. And you know, when I was reading the piece in the Times about people showing up, the stylists and others showing up to kind of pack up their boxes of their equipment, some of them with tears in their eyes, that doesn't sound like a very pleasant scene. I mean, yes, you would hope that bosses would do the right thing, which would be to sit everybody down. But it's also, it might not be practical. Like, are you going to call an all-staff meeting? Are you going to make somebody come in who lives in Kent? They're going to have to come in on a Monday morning when it's not their normal shift to sit in this room with everybody else so you can tell everybody at once, we're shutting it down.
Well, they used to do it that way, or else you'd have everybody come in for a one-on-one, and then the word starts to leak out. Why is the boss having these, you know, right? They used to do it that way. This is text message better or worse than old-school mass firing?
I think that it's an efficient way to do it, and I think it's the world we live in. If you are trying to tell me that those stylists are not people who are on their phone pretty much constantly as a form of communication, you've not met a hairstylist in Seattle. Like, they've got that, you know, the toolbox with the equipment in it, and then the license with their photo, and then the phone. That's like always the sort of tableau when you go in to get your haircut. And it's, you know, this is part of the evolving way that we communicate, I think. You know, we to people who didn't grow up with texting, I'm actually one of them, really, it seems impersonal. But if you were to talk to my soon-to-be 22-year-old daughter, texting is how she and her friends talk much of the time. So I think this is probably a generational thing. My heart still goes out to these stylists. I'm not happy they lost their jobs.
Right, right. Okay, final question then. You're saying basically getting fired will always suck. Do it in a text, not ideal, but not that bad. But you could say the same thing about a romantic breakup. So I just want to make, are you advocating dumping by text? Not ideal, but if you grew up with it.
I guess the same has to apply.
Okay.
I mean, I've never been dumped, Bill. So it's like you're asking me to go into a hypothetical world that is hard for me to enter. But I think if, again, the analogy I think is the same. it would be better for the people at this salon to have sat down the staffers and said it face to face. And it would be better in relationships if we had the huevos to say it face to face. But we live in an imperfect world.
Indeed. Okay, that's the future of getting dumped. Coming up, the future of sitting in traffic. You can decide which is better or worse. And we'll talk about dumping Trump as well as the record continues on KUOW. Your morning commute might look very different in the not-so-distant future. There's a new light rail station opening in the U District this spring, one in Capitol Hill. Rail is coming to Mercer Island, Bellevue, Redmond, Northgate, maybe Tacoma, Everett, Ballard, West Seattle. Some rail skeptics say, wait. Automated cars are just around the corner. They could turn these huge, expensive mass transit projects into white elephants. Well, I put that question to the head of the Washington State Transportation Center at the University of Washington, and Mark Hallenbeck told me self-driving cars will help traffic, just not enough.
The legitimate hope is that you can double the capacity of the freeways with the automation that we can envision. So essentially, cars drive half as far away and then have fewer crashes. And the result is that you double the number of vehicles on a freeway. And that is a very reasonable, in our lifetime, kind of decision, presuming that I live 10 years.
Okay, so, I hope so. So then, in that case, why spend so much, tens of billions of dollars, on rail?
Doubling the capacity of the freeway doesn't come close to the amount of person movement, vehicle movement that you're going to need in a growing and continually growing urban area, another million people roughly in this area in the next 15 years.
Oh.
So you still have to move an awful lot of people. And even if the freeways work, you've got to get them off the freeways. And there's some very definite concern that even with automation, you can't stuff enough vehicles through.
Okay, so you just outlined heaven. What is the hell scenario?
Hell is when you look at that heaven and try to apply it to Sammamish or Montlake Terrace or a place where parking is free and everybody has to drive. So quickly you do the math and you say, I'm going to buy my own car. Once you have your own car and it can drive itself, you send it to do all kinds of trips that you wouldn't make. So your car takes you to work. It goes back home. You've just doubled the amount of mileage on the freeway. When it gets home, it picks up your oldest kid, takes him to high school, comes back, picks up the next kid, takes him to middle school, goes back, takes up the next kid, goes to elementary school, comes back. Oh, it's got to go get your laundry. It goes
more
to get
trips.
The road per car is more efficient, but you've dumped all of this extra traffic on top of it. And that's where the hell part comes in, is because all these things are going in. Maybe you don't care that it takes you 2 hours to get to work because you are busy typing your report for the day in the car. We're productive.
It's not a waste of time.
It's not you're playing. Well, of course, you're on Facebook most of the time, but you're pretending to work. Yeah. So, but people really like interaction. You know, can you change society through the fact you spend 2 hours in your pod on the way in? Is that suffice? So you only need to be in the office 6 hours instead of eight? Well, that's an interesting question. And if society changes to adopt that, which it probably would have to, then maybe hell isn't so much hell.
Let me make one more pitch for the beautiful future. Mm-hmm. The problem will shrink because what we hate about traffic is the stress. He cut me off. She won't let me merge. He's going too slowly. And we hate the unpredictability of when we're going to get there. Automated cars solves that. So even if the roads are packed, we don't mind. We don't need to spend as much on mass transit.
If they're all automated, there's a chance of that, a positive chance. But remember, you're going to have to get all the way to all automated. And so am I going to see this in my lifetime? No, because like I say, you'll start to see automated cars in 5 years. But then even in 5 years, it takes 12 years to do fleet turnover. And so we're talking a minimum of 20 years before you really have a whole lot of these things really out there, because even 5 years from now, it's going to take a long time between automated cars at the high end and 15 years from now when the low end starts to come in. So even when automated cars, it's not a one-for-one swap out. You've got a big buildup time to make that happen, to drive down the production costs. So there's an awful lot going in. So 20 years, yeah. But then you still have the issue of if you own it, you get hell. If Google owns it, you get heaven.
How do you feel about us depending on private companies for something as big and vital as how we move? Like Google's going to – heaven depends on Google?
Well, that has its own heaven and hell outcome. If Google is controlled, it controls the system. The good news about it is they have the technology to understand their own technology, and they have an incentive to keep the car maintained. If it breaks and you own it, is Google at fault because it's their software? Is GM at fault because they built the car? Or are you at fault because you didn't do the maintenance? So that one of the great advantages of Google owning it is, in fact, that you have one person to point at. It's all Google's fault if something breaks. When you start to own it, that liability question when stuff goes wrong, and stuff goes wrong, that becomes nastier, uglier, and the system will not work as well. The downside is do you trust Google? Do they become the Borg? And those are fascinating questions in and of itself. You give up an awful lot of your privacy. You give up an awful lot of control of your own life when you are, in fact, relying on Google. That's why in a place like Ballard, where Google can give you a car and Apple can give you a car and Uber can give you a car, your response time is way better and you get six different people you get to choose from. In Sammamish or in Burien or White Center, that market isn't there. And you really expect the city to run them? Do you want, if you don't want Google to run your cars, do you really want the city to run them? So those environments aren't nearly as conducive to the private sector. And so that generates, again, some things that work against the heaven of Google running the system. So there's lots of unknowns in here, unfortunately.
The unknowns and the heaven and the hell, and that's Mark Hallenbeck painting the picture for you. He directs the Washington State Transportation Center at the University of Washington. I'm Bill Radke, also with us, the host of Public Radio's Live Wire, Luke Burbank. Luke, what do you think of that picture of your driving future?
I see a lot of frustration when you're sitting in your robot-controlled car and it is doing, it's following its robot-controlled rules for the road. I mean, listen, I've had relationships almost end over how frustrated I become with how the other person is driving. Mm. Can you imagine when your Google Chrome mobile is not merging in traffic or not getting around that slower car or not doing whatever it is you as a human would do because it has been programmed to not do that, or it's working off of this very complex mathematical algorithm about what is the most efficient thing?
The prime directive.
That's right. I can't do that, Bill. I'm sorry. I know the bumper stickers on that car in front of you are annoying you. Uh-huh. It says, I don't drive fast, I just fly low, but I can't get you around them, Bill. You know what I mean? Like, it's going to take us multiple generations to actually get to the point where you can relax in your pod, because we're going to be analyzing if the car is doing what we think it should be doing. Also, I hadn't thought of it till I heard that interview, this idea that there's going to be a long in-between time where we have some of the cars on the road are the I'll just call them robot cars, and a lot of the cars are not.
Right.
And what they found in researching this is that most of the accidents that happen when you try to put unmanned vehicles on the road are because the unmanned vehicles, like, make a complete stop, they follow the rules, and the human piloted vehicles don't know what to do with
we
that
are not programmed
and crash into
that.
Them.
Yes.
That's right.
So you're getting at something.
I mean, it's going to be complicated.
Yeah, you're getting at something very interesting, which we don't usually talk about around car automation, is that to those of us living now, at least that have been driving a while, driving is fun. Driving is even a personal expression. So are we ready to give that up? I found something really interesting, this idea that we still need expensive mass transit, because when the roads get more efficient, we'll just send our robot cars all over the place. Because I'm not just going to park it at work. I'm at work and my car is zipping, doing all my errands. So we get to Clogsville. I want to bounce one last thing off you, Luke, before we move on here, which is that you've said how much you hate. You kept moving partly
yes.
because of Seattle traffic. You hate it that much. If I was talking to Mark Hallenbeck there about the wonderful future, arguably. I would ask the same thing to you about our present, that you're in a climate-controlled chair with your phone, your radio, your podcast, your audiobooks, your quiet time, if that's what you want. I submit that if you plan for it, traffic is pleasant right now.
I mean, I agree that it would be a lot – ultimately, it would be much less stressful than what we currently do, where we are having to stay engaged mentally this whole time.
Right.
And so I do think there would be some upside, but – the other thing is this idea that if we're all driving in our pod for like an hour a day and then to come into work and then we're going to spend an hour getting home and so now we should only work 6 hours, I don't think we're going to only work 6 hours, most people. What you're talking about is the workday just getting longer, time spent away from your family getting longer potentially. So while you might be somewhere, in fact, there are people listening that would like to spend less time with their family. I respect that. Maybe this is a magic solution for, for those of you. But you know what I mean? I see a day where we get in our pod at 5:30 a.m. and it spends 3 hours getting us across 5:20, during which time we're doing all of our social media stuff, whatever. Then we go to work, we work a full day, then we get back in the pod and it's like 11 o'clock at night when we get home.
KUW's Luke Burbank with us, who lives close to Canada. He could get away from a lot of trouble if he just move a little bit farther north. And what about you? What would it take for you to finally fulfill your Facebook promise to move to Canada? Stay tuned. If Donald Trump is elected president, I am leaving the country. No, I'm not talking about me. This is what you see a lot on social media. 4% of all Trump-related tweets made that threat earlier this year, according to a digital analytics company. These threats to move happen almost every presidential election year, but does anybody really do it? Yes, in fact, Tom Curtis did. The former Seattleite and his husband vowed to decamp for Canada after George W. Bush was elected. They now live off the coast of northern British Columbia in the village of Queen Charlotte, where Tom works as a public school teacher. Tom Curtis, welcome to KUOW.
Thank you.
Why did George W. Bush's election push you north to Canada?
I was opposed to the Iraq war and to the torture, and I was tired of being treated like a political football when it came to same-sex marriage. I felt like I was being used as a distraction when there were these bigger issues.
Well, same-sex marriage is a personal issue to you. Your life, could, especially back then, could be different if you moved. But beyond that, if you just don't like a candidate's policies, what good does moving do?
I think it has to be deeper than disagreeing with a candidate. For me, it was the system seemed completely broken. And what I found in Canada is the system isn't broken in the same way it is in the U.S. So things like Donald Trump, I don't think are possible in Canada because democracy functions here.
Well, let's talk about what Canada's like. You've lived there since 2007. You've gotten a feel for the place. Let's talk about your new home. Americans often say Canadians are always polite, never rude. What's been your experience with that?
Well, when I first moved here, I felt like I was either a very polite American or a slightly rude Canadian.
Mm-hmm.
But what I found is that there's just different ways of being rude because the countries are different and there's different cultures. So if you want to be rude in Canada, you do it slightly differently if you want to be rude in the United States.
What's the difference?
Well, I think in Canada, what's rude is, if you want to be really rude, you just essentially ignore the point that someone made or act like it's not there. And in the U.S., it's going to be more direct and upfront.
Right, right. Not so much in Seattle, maybe. Maybe Canada's sounding like Seattle, passive-aggressive, perhaps.
Well, you know, it's interesting because passive-aggressive is a word that, Canadians will often joke about or Americans will joke about Canadians. But I actually don't think it's passive-aggressive. I think it's passive-assertive. And once you realize that people are actually being assertive when they seem passive, it's not aggression, it's just how you get things done here.
Okay. You've also found that a phrase, "we'll just work through the process," means something different in Canada. What is that?
It means the train's already left the station. So if someone says to you, "we'll just work through the process," that means that probably your idea isn't going to happen.
We'll just work through a process that has left you behind.
Exactly. And so there, it seems like it's passive, but it's actually pretty straightforward. And once you once I figured out what the code meant and how people talk differently here, I realized that Canadians, you know, do have points of view and they do know how to get things done and how to reach a consensus. And sometimes I think that we use the same words with different meanings. And so it's difficult at first as an American to hear things and think, oh, that's what they mean. And then you find out actually that yes meant no.
Right. Okay. Final question, Tom. If someone listening is thinking of moving to Canada, should they go through with it if their nightmare candidate wins?
If they want to live in a place that invests in public education and supports general health care and really takes democracy seriously, then they should move.
Tom Curtis, former Seattleite, moved to Canada after George W. Bush won the second time around. Tom, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Our guest this hour, Luke Burbank's been moving toward Canada for years.
Yeah, I can almost see it from here, man.
I know. This is where he records his podcast, TBTL, and he can live anywhere he wants. Luke, would any candidate make you move that extra mile, that last mile north over the border?
I'll tell you that Tom was making a pretty compelling argument talking about the way that democracy works up in Canada and, you know, the idea of funding important projects, not having to maybe fight as much for some of those basic things. But I'll tell you, we have some things in America they don't have up there, like a TJ Maxx and also a Trader Joe's. I know this because when I go to what I think of as very banal American stores, there are hundreds of British Columbia plates in the parking lots of the malls and other places in Bellingham. I mean, it's like incredible. For all of the great advances that the nation of Canada has made, it does not apparently extend to affordable apparel or whatever else it is they're selling at TJ Maxx. That being said, you know, I don't actually, Bill, you know, this is public radio and I know people, everybody tries to stay somewhat neutral on these things. I was watching the caucus in Iowa last night, and I have to say I'm not personally a big fan of the idea of Donald Trump being president of the country. And so I was interested to see what would happen to him. And then when Ted Cruz won and gave his speech midway through, I thought, can we get that Trump guy back? I don't really know who I'm rooting for in this case. I do feel confident, though, that the political climate in Washington is so gridlocked at this point that whoever gets elected, their impact will be limited. I take some weird comfort in that. Like, even if you put Donald Trump in the White House, I think he would be stymied the way that, you know, Ted Cruz would be stymied, probably the way Hillary or Bernie would be stymied. So I guess our dysfunctional system functions in a certain way in that nobody can really have that much of an impact.
Here's another way to react to a Trump victory, even if you're a Republican. That is to do what the former Washington State Secretary of State has done regarding Donald Trump. We're going to talk with him coming up. KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. One of the Northwest's selling points is its cheap hydropower. That's why data centers have sprouted along the Columbia River. But in north-central Washington, an emerging power-hungry industry is meeting with some resistance. It involves the making and managing of the virtual currency called Bitcoin. KUOW's Tom Bonsi reports from Chelan County.
Bitcoins are traded on the internet. They can be converted to cash, one Bitcoin currently worth about $380. One way to earn Bitcoins is to lend computing horsepower to the global Bitcoin network. That's known as Bitcoin mining. And one place that happens is at Dedicated Hosting Services. That's a one-year-old company that leases a former machine tool shop on the banks of the Columbia River. Michael Cao is the company president.
No one notices that anything is going on there because we're so quiet.
Unlike traditional mining, there are no pickaxes and conveyor belts here. In Bitcoin mining, the tools are tech know-how and electricity, lots of electricity.
Inside there are racks and racks of computers trying to solve a very complicated equation on the Bitcoin network.
Solve the equation, you get an electronic reward of Bitcoins. Do it every day, all day long, the rewards can add up. Cao and his partners make their money by leasing rack space to Bitcoin miners. Cheap electricity is the attraction for locating Bitcoin computers in north central Washington. Some of the lowest electric rates in the nation come courtesy of dams operated by several local public utilities. But a few months ago, Chelan County PUD proposed to roughly double the Bitcoiners' power rates. Jared Richardson is Cow's business partner.
This rate change is very narrowly targeted and is discriminatory and would pretty well wipe out our business in the area.
The proposed rate hike affects about a dozen existing Bitcoin server farms in Chelan County. It comes on the heels of a moratorium on new high-intensity electric hookups. John Stoll is a manager with Chelan PUD.
We do have these wonderful assets, the hydroelectric dams on the Columbia River, as well as Lake Chelan, that generate enough power for the county, as well as some extra power that is sold throughout the Northwest and on the West Coast that helps, you know, offset rates locally.
But Stoll says this cheap power is a finite resource. The emerging Bitcoin industry has power managers concerned about spare capacity being gobbled up. The Wenatchee-based utility is now proposing to charge the Bitcoin mines a higher rate than any of its other local customers. That's sparked debate over fairness and what a sustainable business model looks like along the Columbia River. The PUD admits it's still trying, like most of us, to figure out what this whole Bitcoin thing is about.
There's probably stories in business journals every day about the fall of Bitcoin to it is the next internet.
Stoll says the volatility in the digital currency business is also a concern.
We've seen some operations go in and almost overnight they're gone. And that creates issues for a utility.
A longtime local businessman with a foot in the old and the new has become a go-between in the quest for an amicable solution. Malachi Salcido runs a mechanical contractor business in Wenatchee. Recently, he's expanded into Bitcoin mining. Salcido says the underlying technology, called blockchain, could grow into something bigger in central Washington, but he fears the PUD's wariness could quash the opportunity.
The utility has said, if we do this, we can't keep low stable rates for our customers. My response to them is that's not a good enough answer. Either or is not a good enough answer. We are all very intelligent. We can collaborate and work together. We have to figure out a way to do both.
Something along those lines may be happening. The elected utility commissioners have put the rate hike on the slow track and directed staff to explore alternatives. The Bitcoiners also are looking at alternatives. That includes going to neighboring counties with similar low power rates if and when they decide to expand. I'm Tom Bonsi in Wenatchee, Washington.
KUOW's The Record. Good afternoon. I'm Bill Radke. Donald Trump supporters may be disappointed about his second place finish last night in the Iowa caucus. But one Washington Republican is happy about it. Former Secretary of State Ralph Monroe dislikes Donald Trump so much that he's sending anyone who wants one a bumper sticker that says, "Dump Trump." Ralph Monroe joins us, happens to be in Palm Springs, California this afternoon. Hi, Ralph.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well, thank you. You are retired. You could spend your days doing a lot of different things. Why are you distributing bumper stickers that say, "Dump Trump"?
Oh, I just finally got so sick of the guy, I had to do something. And I thought, well, this might be an easy way to step forward and make my opinions known, so I had bumper strips printed and have been handing them out to my friends.
What does that involve? How do you design and print that thing?
Well, you just find a printer, and it doesn't take much to print a bumper strip.
Okay.
I just can't stand Trump, and so I thought I'd better speak my voice.
What is it that bothers you about Donald Trump?
Well, I don't think he understands our state and the business that we're in, the world trade business. I think he's a racist. I think his statements against Muslims and his statements against Hispanics are absolutely terrible, and we're the party of Lincoln, and I just don't like it.
Because there are different criticisms about Trump. There's that kind of stuff, that he's bigoted, et cetera, which you describe. There's also the he's not conservative enough, he's not a true conservative. Is that also part of an argument from you?
I'm frankly not sure what he is. He's taken so many positions, all of them seeming to benefit himself. I think he'll do anything to benefit himself financially or personally or vote-wise. And some of the things he states, the statements he made, are not only inappropriate and immature, but they're just plain cruel. What he said about Carly Fiorini, and who I don't know either of these people, but that's just a cruel statement and nothing that should be coming from the mouth of a potential president of the United States.
You've been giving away about 250 so far of these Dump Trump bumper stickers. Who's requesting them?
Oh, everybody. Just people on the street. They see them on my car and ask, hey, where'd you get that? And the people have written to me. It's been on Facebook, and so people have written to me and asked me to mail them one. I'm happy to do so. I'm not trying to organize a big campaign here. It just, I guess it satisfies my own desire to make my opinion known. I just don't think the guy is an appropriate person to call himself a Republican.
Well, I think I would discount a Dump Trump bumper sticker just because I would assume, well, that's like a lot of people around me in Seattle. They're not going to vote for Trump or any other Republican. Does it say anywhere on the bumper sticker, hey, what's interesting here is this is Republicans against Trump?
No, it's got my name and address and so forth on it, but I think there's people on both sides of the aisle that feel the same way. But there's I also have a lot of Democratic friends who probably will end up voting Republican because they don't feel comfortable with either of those two candidates. It always goes back and forth. There's a lot of Republicans who may end up voting Democrat. In our state, that's one of the glories of our state. You can vote for anybody you want to. You don't have to register as a party.
Well, things get pretty passionate. I mean, we're talking about control of the White House. How are your fellow Republicans reacting when they find out that you are advocating against the potential Republican nominee?
You know, in Washington State, I have not encountered, well, I guess I should say I've encountered only one active, longtime Republican who supports Trump. Virtually everybody else, some people scoff at him and laugh at him and say, well, he's our Archie Bunker, and let him keep it up because he knows how to push all the hot buttons for a while. But the vast majority, there was a conference of, 500 or 600 Republicans this past weekend out at the Ocean, and I don't think Trump got one vote when they did the straw poll. Now, I could be incorrect on that, but as I understood the results, he didn't get one vote. And I know just walking down the street and walking around the legislative building and talking to longtime Republican activists around the state, I don't know anybody that supports him.
Well, I realize in the Puget Sound area, we're a pretty liberal spot, but statewide in Republican enclaves of Washington State, Republican areas, and you know there are many, why would Washington State Republicans be any different from Republicans across America who are giving Trump their support in all these polls?
Well, I know that people poll as Republicans in those polls, but the question is, are they brand-new voters, or have they voted before? A lot of those polls indicate that these are folks that haven't voted in the past. There's no question there's a movement out there. It's kind of like the same people that Ross Perot captured. But if we aren't careful as a party, this man will run as a third candidate and could defeat any potential chance that we have to have victory at the White House. And so this is always a concern early on when you get a wild card like this.
Do you think Washington State Republicans are really much different from a Republican anywhere else in America? And if so, how?
Sometimes they are, and mostly based on the economy we have. I think they're more interested in world trade. I think they understand how our economy is built into the whole world economic system and where we sell to and where we buy from. So I think they're more cautious about that, and they look at people who are going to enhance world trade, not hurt world trade. I think they're also more willing and open to accept people of all nationalities, races, and ethnic backgrounds, much more than many other locations across America. And you can see that in our schools, and you can see it in our community and in our businesses and so forth. So I think there probably is a difference.
Finally, we're talking with the former Washington Secretary of State, Ralph Monroe, Republican. Finally, if Donald Trump becomes president, despite your Dump Trump stickers, what are you going to do with all those stickers?
Well, by that time, they'll all have been distributed, and we'll see what the next step is. But obviously, I would support any person who wins the candidacy of the United States and be willing to try to be a loyal American. But I certainly don't support him in these primaries. There's a lot better candidates out there.
If he's the nominee, you'll vote Democrat and advocate others vote Democrat?
No, I didn't say that yet. I'll just wait and see.
Okay. Ralph Monroe, you get to do that. Retired Secretary of State. Served for 20 years. Thanks for talking with us, Ralph.
Thank you.
He lives in Olympia now, joined us, though, just there from Palm Springs, California. I'm Bill Radke with the host of Public Radio's Live Wire on Saturday evenings, Luke Burbank. Luke, reaction to Republicans for dumping Trump on the bumper sticker?
Well, first of all, if I were the retired Secretary of State, that's exactly where you would find me, too.
Palm Springs,
this time of year. That's the cherry on top of the sundae of having served for all those years. I think that the rise of Donald Trump is so mystifying. I think I can see why it's particularly frustrating to somebody like Ralph Monroe, somebody who spent their life in politics and working from the premise that there are certain rules to the game, that when you talk to the media and large groups of people, you should try to be inclusive. And even if you're proposing something that may be disadvantageous to certain groups, you should try to frame it in a way that it doesn't exactly sound that way, or that it points out what the greater good is, et cetera, et cetera. And Donald Trump exists in total opposition to all of the rules that we think politicians should play by. And I think there are a tremendous number of Americans who are very frustrated and feel like America does not work for them any longer. I saw this tweet from a reporter for the Financial Times who was in Iowa yesterday. He said an Iowa caucus goer just told an NPR presenter that she was supporting Trump because of the way he rebuilt the World Trade Center.
Mm.
I mean, I think you have two things going on. I think you have a great misunderstanding of what Donald Trump has actually done in his life and has stood for in the past and now currently stands for. But then you've also just got a lot of people who think the problem is Washington. The problem is politics as usual. My standard of living is not what it was. The prospects for my kids are not what the prospects were for me. America doesn't work for me. And Donald Trump is somehow the answer. And for people who don't have that feeling, it's hard to wrap your mind around why Trump continues to be popular. But it just speaks, I think, to the general dissatisfaction a lot of Americans feel.
It was very interesting to hear Ralph Monroe saying that he thinks Republicans in this state are different because we are interested in world trade. We're more open. We're more accepting. Maybe our better economy, the economic boom we've seen in this state, even reduces the level of frustration in Washington. We'll see. It's KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for tuning in. When KUOW listeners get stuck for what to read, help is a phone call away, as long as the person on the other end is Nancy Pearl. Here is Nancy and KUOW's Marcy Silman working our Book Lovers Hotline.
This is Bruce. I'm calling from Seebeck, Washington.
Oh, wow. What do you do in Seebeck?
Well, I'm retired. I'm actually up at our family's cabin. Had the boat out this morning, took a little troll around, got some oysters for lunch. Took the dog for a walk, and now I'm talking to you. Nice to be retired.
Well, so you have a little time for reading, Bruce. What book have you recently read that you just love?
Well, I read the Journals of Lewis and Clark by Bernard DeVoto. I savored it over about a three-month period and just finished it, not that long ago.
Why did you love the Journals of Lewis and Clark?
Well, I've always been a big fan of Lewis and Clark from a very early age. Read a lot about them, and then especially after I retired, was able to take some motorcycle trips and kind of replicate a lot of their journey from the Yellowstone area back to Washington and Oregon.
Wait, you went from Yellowstone to the coast on a motorcycle?
Well, yes. A couple of years ago, we took a long trip on our bikes and ended up in Yellowstone, and we went over Lolo Pass, which was one of their arduous climbs when they came across the Rocky Mountains. And this past October, we took another trip, and we went down the Columbia River from Lewiston, Clarkston, all the way to Vancouver, Washington. And that replicated most of the journey that they had along the Columbia River.
I'm curious, Bruce, what it is about Lewis and Clark that sparks this curiosity and passion in you.
Well, my grandfather was a big buff of all things Western history. In fact, he supported his family by writing articles, but what he really wrote was monthly pulp Western fiction. He did that for 15 or 20 years.
So you're telling me that this interest is genetic?
Yeah, I think so. My mom was a big reader, too, and it's just been a lifelong passion.
Well, Nancy, here is Bruce passionate about the history of our area. What do you suggest he try next?
Well, the first thing that I have to say is that Bernard DeVoto was one of the great historians of the mid-20th century, winner of practically every prize under the sun. So, you know, you have really good taste in your historians. And interestingly enough, it was Bernard DeVoto's wife, Avis, who helped Julia Child get her book initially published. So I love those little connections that we could make. So the book that I think that you would really enjoy is a book that came out in 2015 by a man named Rinker Buck, and it's called The Oregon Trail. And it's about a guy who is not quite at retirement age, but who decides that what he's going to do is recreate the experiences of the pioneers who went west, beginning in St. Joseph, Missouri, and going out to the coast. But he does it not on a motorcycle, which would be fun enough, not by car. No, he decides that he's going to recreate the entire experience in a buckboard wagon drawn by mules. And this is the account of his trip. And it's absolutely wonderful. I mean, you get so much history, and you will end up the book knowing more than you ever thought possible about mules and the mules in America. And then I might read, just for fun, because you like the area, and so did Bernard DeVoto, his other books. One I read that I really enjoyed was Across the Wide Missouri, which won both the Pulitzer and Bancroft Prize, that one book, but really is how the fur trade shaped the American West. So you might take a look at those. So happy somebody, you know, who's not in school getting a history degree reading Bernard DeVoto. I suspect that you've, since your grandfather wrote those, you know, I would call them penny dreadful westerns.
My grandmother thought they were penny dreadful.
Well, Bruce, we have just given you probably several months of reading, given that you have the oystering and the dogs and all those other fun things that
you're doing. And the motorcycle.
And the motorcycles. Okay, have a great time reading, Bruce.
Thanks for calling. And enjoy KUOW a lot. And you too, Nancy.
Thank you.
Thanks. Bye-bye, Bruce.
Okay, so if you're looking for your next good book, call us, 206-221-3663. So we can connect you with Nancy Pearl. Tell us about a book you loved and why, so Nancy can guide you to your next great read. 206-221-3663. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks to producer Amina Al-Sadi, to Live Wire host Luke Burbank. What's on Live Wire, Luke?
Oh, well, you know, that book that Rinker Buck wrote that Nancy Pearl was talking about, we had Rinker Buck on Live Wire a couple months ago. And if you would like to see that kind of interesting stuff, we're starting the show up again, a live recording in Portland, February 17th. We'll have Stephen Tobolowsky there. Modest Yahoo will be the music. And Dale Scott, who's the only openly gay MLB umpire. So check us out in Portland, February 17th.
Check it out.